This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, November 25th, 2013. I'm Christina Thomas. Ozarks at Large is sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs and research through a collective voice. United Cerebral Palsy of Arkansas has offices in Fayetteville, Harrison, Fort Smith, and Russellville. United Cerebral Palsy supports life without limits for people with disabilities and advocates for their inclusion in community life. More information is available at ucpark.org or by calling 966-4322. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large, a look back at the second wave of feminism in politics, the new face of the voter ID law, and Roby Brock tells us Tyson has been doing chicken right in his talk business update. Plus, the use of insects in music. It doesn't happen often. But first, Walmart will soon have a new president at the helm as the retail giant this morning announced its next chief executive officer. Doug McMillon will succeed current CEO Mike Duke in February. McMillon was also elected to the Walmart Board of Directors effective immediately. Duke will continue serving as chairman of the executive committee of the board, and he will also stay on as an advisor to McMillon for 1 year. McMillon will assume the role as CEO after having served as CEO of Walmart's international division since 2009. And before that, he was the president of Sam's Club for 3 years. His career at Walmart began in 1984 as a summer associate at a Walmart distribution center. Mike Duke has been president and CEO of the retail giant since 2009 and has been with the company since 1995. In other Walmart news, the company announced late Friday that its board of directors has appointed a new member to the board. Pamela Craig, the retired chief financial officer of Accenture, was appointed the 15th member of the board. She will also serve as a member of the company's audit committee. According to the CityWire, Craig has extensive experience in finance, technology, and operations from her time at Accenture, a global management, consulting, technology services, and outsourcing company, where she served as CFO from October 2006 until this past July. After the Arkansas legislature passed a law earlier this year creating a new office of the Medicaid Inspector General, the agency has been setting up operations and has recently created a new website. Director Jay Hsu says the new website will provide a chance for anyone to report any suspected waste, fraud, or abuse. He says that the information will lead his staff to investigate.
Some instance of that may be that they see something in the community that they think has to do with Medicaid, and they think it may be fraudulent or wasteful or an abuse of taxpayer dollars, and they can fill out very minimal information so that we can start an investigation and look into what it is that their concern is.
Hsu says most of the employees in the independent agency were inherited from the Department of Human Services Program Integrity Unit. He says the new site will include a hotline where callers can choose to remain anonymous. He says his staff will investigate any plausible cases of fraud.
Some instance of that may be that they see something in the community that they think has to do with Medicaid, and they think it may be fraudulent or wasteful or an abuse of taxpayer dollars, and they can fill out very minimal information so that we can start an investigation and look into what it is that their concern is.
An annual report by the agency shows that since the fiscal year began in July, the agency has reviewed 136 cases. The Department of Human Services Program Integrity Unit, which handled reports before the independent office was created, reviewed 556 cases last year. The primary major in the Department of Crop, Soil, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville is getting a name change. The Dale Bumpers College of Agricultural, Food, and Life Sciences at the U of A announced today that the college's crop management major is being renamed to Crop Science. The name change is meant to reflect the increased emphasis on science and agriculture, particularly the increased reliance on work done at the molecular, genetic, and physiological levels. According to the department, the crop science major focuses on issues dealing with all facets of crop production, particularly to Arkansas crops such as soybeans, rice, cotton, and wheat, as well as pasture grasses. A section of Nettleship Street west of Razorback Road in Fayetteville will be closed this week while contractors relocate water and sewer mains. The utility relocation is in preparation of the future widening of South Razorback Road. Detour signs are in place, and the closure will potentially be in place through Friday. Also starting today, portions of Sang Avenue and Halsell Road in Fayetteville will be closed to through traffic as crews begin construction of new sidewalks and improvements to curbing, guttering, and storm drainage systems. Between the work hours of 7 a.m. and 3 p.m., Sang Avenue will be closed from Cleveland Street to Halsell Road, and Halsell Road will be closed from Sang to Cross Avenue. The work is expected to extend into spring of next year. And continued construction of the 71B flyover will slow traffic in North Fayetteville today and tomorrow. The eastbound shoulder of the Fulbright Expressway will be closed continuously through Tuesday to allow for bridge overhang decking to be installed. In addition, one southbound travel lane and shoulder of College Avenue will be closed between 8 o'clock tonight and 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. Willie Nelson's concert at Walton Arts Center, scheduled for tomorrow evening, has been postponed. This weekend, a bus with members of the singer's band was involved in a crash in inclement weather. One band member suffered a broken hip in the accident. The tour has postponed the rest of the dates for November, including the stop in Fayetteville. No makeup date has been announced. This evening's forecast calls for a 30% chance of precipitation with sleet possible before 7 p.m., then a slight chance of drizzle or freezing drizzle until 1 a.m. Overnight low of 24 in northwest Arkansas and 30 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, Tuesday, cloudy through mid-morning with a gradual clearing in northwest Arkansas. Mostly sunny in the Arkansas River Valley with highs from 42 to 46. Tomorrow evening, mostly clear with overnight lows from 15 in northwest Arkansas to 21 in the Arkansas River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. Arkansas Secretary of State Mark Martin has announced the final installation of new voter ID photographic equipment in every Arkansas county. The project is in compliance with a new state voter ID law, passed this year by the Arkansas legislature. Ozarks at Large, Jacqueline Froelich has more.
According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, 33 states have passed voter ID laws, and on April 1st, the Arkansas House of Representatives voted to overturn a veto by Democratic Governor Mike Beebe of a bill requiring voters in the state to show photo identification at the polls. Arkansas is now the 34th state to enact a voter ID law known as Act 595 of 2013. Alex Reed is Communications Director for Arkansas Secretary of State Mark Martin.
Well, previously the law required for the poll workers to ask them for identification, but it did not require the voter to produce such identification.
Not all Arkansas voters have to rush out to secure a new voter ID card. Reed says the new law lays out alternative ID options.
You can use a variety of identifications under this law. You can use your driver's license. You can use your post-secondary school issued ID, a concealed handgun permit, public assistance identification card, a military ID, or the voter registration card.
A valid employee ID badge will also work. Alex Reed says 89 voter ID digital photography systems have been installed in all 75 county clerk offices, and the public is welcome to go have their picture taken.
Well, what it is, it's basically just a computer system with a camera and a small printer that prints the cards.
Like a driver's license. So how much does it cost?
To the voter, nothing.
The county voter ID systems cost $419,000, budgeted out of the Arkansas Secretary of State's office. Now, to secure your voter ID, you will need to furnish two types of valid non-photo identification to your county clerk.
Your identity document is one, and that can be your birth certificate, your marriage license application, your tax return, a paycheck or a paycheck stub, your Medicare statement, your Social Security statement, your school record transcript, or your DD-214 for members of the military. And that would satisfy your identity requirement when you're going to get this free card. It's another requirement, documentation showing the applicant's name and residential address, and that can be your utility or cable bill, your bank statement, a rental contract, your homeowner's insurance policy, your mortgage papers, your property tax bill, or your W-2. So if your not able to get one of the IDs mentioned before, if you don't have a driver's license, a concealed carry permit, or one of those, then you have to bring one from each section into the county clerk's office so they can prove your identity and your residence. And then you have to sign an affidavit that says you are not able to get another one of the IDs that are valid, and then they will issue one.
Secretary of State Mark Martin, in a press release, stated that voter IDs will provide additional integrity to the state's electoral system.
Well, what they'll be able to do now is poll workers will be able to actually verify if people are who they say they are when they come in to vote.
A voter ID measure was first introduced 6 years ago in Arkansas, failing three times over the years. The 2013 bill sailed through the legislature, pushed by conservatives. Liberal critics claim voter ID laws are a form of voter suppression because obtaining the credential is more difficult for minority and working poor, studies show, who tend to skew Democratic. In any case, Alex Reed says they're launching a big campaign to inform voters about the cards.
Correct. That's going to be our biggest part in this law, is we've got to make sure that we educate voters about showing your ID. We've set up a website. It's called faceyourvote.org. People can visit that and learn more about the law and what it entails. We'll work through local radio, newspaper, television where we can, depending on what our budget allows for us to spend.
The Brennan Center for Justice, based at New York University School of Law, cites 11% of all eligible voters in the United States lack proper photo ID. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Later today, songs from the Civil War.
Hurrah, hurrah, we bring the jubilee.
We think of a lot of the songs as drifting up out of the campfires and the trenches of the war itself, but they were composed.
While we were marching through Georgia.
The new collection, Divided and United, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen this afternoon from 3 to 6 to 91.3 FM.
Our Ozarks at Large insect expert, Dr. Donald Steinkraus, loves music. In particular, rock and roll and the blues. He plays guitar and has been in various bands, even playing a few gigs at George's in Fayetteville. As he is an entomologist, Dr. Steinkraus gets a kick out of bugs' use in popular culture, and in particular, in music. He brought some insect tunes to the Carver Center for Public Radio, including one of his favorites, Boris the Spider by The Who.
Crawling up my wall, black and hairy, very small. Now he's up above my head.
It's in a genre I'd call a true story, because the whole story is about a spider who he's named Boris, and he sees Boris on his wall. And he doesn't like Boris. And so then he picks a book up off the floor and he squashes Boris. And so that's a song that's completely about an arthropod, about the spider. And so it's not just an incidental use of a phrase or a word, but it's a true story. And one thing I think is that most of us have had that story in our life at one time or another.
What, where we find a spider crawling up the wall?
And you squash it.
Yeah.
Have you ever done that?
I have.
I did it one day just recently. I saw a spider. I didn't like it. And I threw a magazine at it and squashed it. You know, so I really like the fact that John Entwistle wrote this song that's very true to life. But it's also a great rock and roll song because it's got a really heavy bass in it. Has a funny little refrain called Creepy Crawly where they all say, you know, Pete Townsend and John Entwistle sort of go creepy crawly, creepy crawly, creepy creepy creepy. You know, you'll hear it.
So it's kind of the hook.
Yeah.
There he is, wrapped in the ball.
It's just a neat song. Yeah, but along that same line, I read recently that someone did some kind of study that claims that about 75% of the human race is afraid of spiders.
I can see that.
Yeah.
They sort of have a bad rap, for sure.
They do, but it seems innate or something, too. There's something about them that people don't like them. I'm sure some of it's learned, but your average person just doesn't like spiders.
Well, I just turned the page of these lyrics, and I see the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, this is another one. I guess one thing I'd like to say is that insects get used in rock and roll not terribly commonly. It's not like it's probably say it's like less than 5% of the songs in rock and roll have an insect involved in them. And then a lot of those are just incidental uses, like using honey. The word honey means the product of the beehive, but we use it in our romantic lives
exactly,
all the time.
Yeah.
So you see the word honey in many, many songs, but that's not really a true, it's not much entomological use. But the Rolling Stones wrote another song called The Spider and the Fly, which again is a very good story. And it's the story of the Stones on tour. It's one of the early songs. And they've gotten done with their gig, and they're kind of bored. And they're sitting at a bar, and he keeps remembering that his girlfriend back home or his wife told him, don't fool around on the trip. But he's bored. And so he keeps noticing women in the bar, and he gets tempted. So it's a story of temptation, really, and the story is like, it's got this whole refrain in it, don't say hi like a spider to a fly, jump right ahead and you're dead. So,
well, like a fly gets caught in a spider's web.
Right, right.
Don't say hi like a spider to a fly, jump right ahead and you're dead.
So I mentioned earlier that like some songs just have a short bit about an insect in them. A couple that come to mind are Little Wing by Jimi Hendrix. And in there, he just says that it's a lovely song, I think. He says that this woman he really likes is dreamy. He says she's got a circus mind that's running round butterflies and zebras and moonbeams and fairy tales. So that's the only reference to the insect in the song is butterflies. But it evokes a whole thing. What does it evoke to you, do you think?
Well, I mean, kind of whimsical. Light and easy, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Another one like that, that it just has one reference, is The Circle Game by Joni Mitchell. And The Circle Game is a terrific song about growing older, you know, and going from a child to being an adult. But the first line is, yesterday a child came out to wonder, caught a dragonfly inside a jar. And so that sets the whole tone. It's a childhood experience catching an insect like a dragonfly or...
Well, it's definitely a childhood experience to catch insects in a jar. I have a niece, and she was visiting this summer, and she's 4.
Uh-huh.
And we caught grasshoppers, you know, in uh-huh. cups. She really liked to do the grasshopper thing.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah.
But there's another one where there's only one reference to an insect. It's just caught a dragonfly inside a mm-hmm. jar. But it's important for the song, its success as a lyric,
a child
I think.
Came out to wonder, caught a dragonfly inside a jar. Fearful. When the sky was full of thunder.
Another one which I think hinges on the insects is Bob Dylan's song, Day of the Locusts. This is an interesting song because I think it's a true story of Dylan when he got an honorary degree at a university, and he went to get the degree. But something about being at the university sort of oppressed him or something. And he keeps saying, is like the last lines in each verse are that the locusts sang off in the distance. The locusts sang with such a sweet melody. The locusts sang off in the distance, and they were singing for me, he says. They sort of recall him to himself. I think that they... You know, he doesn't belong there at the university system. He belongs out in nature, you know, in some other world besides sort of the academic world. Sometimes people get things wrong in the song. They, like he keeps saying locusts, which works, but they're not locusts in the trees.
Was he thinking of cicadas?
Mm-hmm, that's what I think, because cicadas sing in the daytime. They're in the trees, and maybe when he wrote this, there was one of those mass emergences. I don't know. I'd have to look up the date, but... generally, locusts aren't in the trees, and they're not singing. Locusts are grasshoppers, and but it works as a song. It's a really, really good song, I think. let's talk about some honeybees for a moment, if you've got time. So there's many songs that are about a honeybee. Stevie Ray Vaughan has a song called Honeybee, and usually there's some inaccuracies in there. He says, like a queen bee's honey. Well, queen bees don't make honey, but that's okay. But there's always this use of like a honey as love is sweet and a girl is sweet. And then he says, I'm the king, baby. Buzz with me. Dive in your hive and into your life. Tell me, little baby, that you'll buzz me all the time. Sort of, what is the word for it? Euphemism? Is that the right word?
I think so.
You know, are you a double entendre, I guess, is another word for it.
Well, but there is no king bee.
That's true. There's no king bee either. No, the drones are all sons and brothers.
Like a queen bee's honey, you as sweet as can be. I am the king, baby. Buzz with me.
The names of bands, for instance, Buddy Holly's band was called the Crickets.
Okay.
So they're straight crickets, you know, for a rock band. And I'm not an expert on rock history, but from what I understand, Buddy Holly's group was one of the first sort of songwriter, guitar-based groups, sort of established that ensemble of bass, guitar, drums. And I think they originally had two guitarists. And they were sort of the model for the Beatles. And when I looked at how the Beatles came up with their name, and originally they did call themselves, they did think, like, named themselves sort of after the Crickets. And originally they had it spelled with two E's, and then they changed it to B-A-T-L-E-S. So it was sort of a double meaning, both Beatles and beat. But so there's probably the most important rock group of all time,
right,
the Beatles. And their name is sort of insect-related to the crickets. And then there's other groups like Iron Butterfly, which is an old, heavy, sort of hippie band. And then I was thinking of the singer from The Police, Sting, because apparently his name was sort of derived from honeybees.
Well, Sting, yeah.
Well, it said in, I looked up on Wikipedia, but it said here that one of some band leaders thought that he had a sweater that was black and yellow on and it made him look like a bee, and they started calling him Sting. And his real name is Gordon, but he no longer answers to the name Gordon. It's always to the name Sting.
Well, I didn't know his name was Gordon, so if I ever met him, I would definitely call him Sting.
Yeah, that's
right.
I mean,
for sure.
Yeah. So sometimes the names of these groups are important and are based on insects.
Do you have a favorite
song? Of these bug ones?
Well, just in general. Is it about a bug?
No, probably not.
No, okay.
No. I have lots of songs I like, but I just like these ones because it is fun to see something in your discipline being used in this way. And one thing about entomology is that it does relate to a lot of people. Like, you don't see a lot of songs about plant pathogens. Like, we have a whole department of plant pathology, but nobody writes a song about leaf spots or something. So we do get this interaction with rock and roll and blues and other genres.
Yeah, poetry, movies, things that we've talked about
before. Yeah,
yeah. Dr. Donald Steinkraus is an entomologist at the University of Arkansas. We hear from him once a month on Ozarks at Large.
Every day, it's getting closer, going faster than a roller coaster. Love like yours will surely come my way. Hey, hey, hey. Every day, it's getting...
While Tyson reported record earnings for its fiscal year, the same did not happen for Bentonville-based Car-Mart. Roby Brock with content partner Talk Business Arkansas has more in this weekly update.
Tyson Foods closed its fiscal year on a strong note as it posted record sales and earnings while announcing several leadership changes in its management structure. The Springdale-based meat company recorded fourth quarter earnings of $261 million on sales of $8.9 billion. 1 year ago, Tyson Foods posted net income of $185 million on revenue of $8.3 billion. For the full year, Tyson Foods registered profits of $778 million, Revenue topped $34.3 billion. In the previous fiscal year, Tyson recorded net income of $583 million on sales of $33 billion. America's Car-Mart reported higher sales and lower profits as company officials noted that competitive pressures continue to squeeze margins. The Bentonville-based Buy Here, Pay Here used car dealer posted net income of $5.8 million in its second quarter. That was down from $7.3 million 1 year ago. Revenues, however, climbed higher to $121 million compared to $110 million for the prior year's quarter. Vietnamese-based Vinh Long, a manufacturer of a variety of home furnishing products made from natural fiber mixed with industrial materials, will locate a new manufacturing facility in the former Bosch building in Morrilton. The company will invest $5 million in the plant and add 75 workers. The new facility, to be known as Vinh Long Arkansas Limited, will manufacture storage furniture and kitchen cabinets for potential retailers such as IKEA and other outlets. American Tubing of Springdale, a leading producer of copper assemblies and components for use in the air conditioning and refrigeration industries, announced plans on Wednesday to expand. The company will add a $3.2 million 20,000 square foot addition to its Springdale location, including 50 new jobs. A study commissioned by the Arkansas legislature suggested the state could realize more than $100 million in savings each year from a variety of programs under the umbrella of the Department of Human Services. The Alexander Group report includes 32 recommendations for short-term and long-term initiatives. It claims the short-term initiatives could save the state between $65 and $98 million a year, and that the long-term initiatives could save the state between $46 and $63 million a year. Home sales in Arkansas remained strong in October, rising nearly 14% from 1 year ago. Craighead County had a particularly robust month, with home sales jumping nearly 65% from October 2012. Average home prices for the month dipped 2% statewide. Year-to-date, home sales in Arkansas have risen more than 12% from 1 year ago, and average home prices are up 2%. I'm Roby Brock, and this has been your Talk Business Arkansas update.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large comes from Bank of the Ozarks. Committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com. Six years ago this month, more than 20,000 women gathered in Houston for the National Women's Conference, an event created by President Ford's executive order a few years before. The goal was to determine policy on issues from equal pay to child care funding to reproductive rights. The big conference followed a series of smaller ones in each state designed to help establish the topics for the national conference.
In many ways, it was a culmination of lots of things that had been happening for about 10 years. I also think that it was a sign of things to come and the beginnings of a very different political culture in our society and one that we're still living with.
The Equal Rights Amendment, of course, was a hot, very, it would lead the nightly news, the discussion about that. And at that point, did it not seem to a lot of people that the Equal Rights Amendment was well on its way to being adopted? I mean, it had gone through the Senate and the House with relative ease, had the support of President Nixon, a Republican, Spiro Agnew, George Wallace?
George Wallace, too.
Okay. How did this... Right?
Yes. The ERA goes all the way back to 1923 when it was introduced by Alice Paul and the Women's Party, but feminists themselves were very divided on it for, decades. And but finally, it came to the point in the early 70s where pretty much all women's organizations that were progressive in nature, venerable ones like the League of Women Voters and the AAUW and the BPW, as well as the new feminist organizations like NOW that had recently been created, everyone was unified on it. And in the early 70s, this was a period in which the women's movement just had tremendous support in Congress from both Democrats and Republicans, where the Nixon administration, the Congress, and the Supreme Court were all coming, handing down victories to the women's movement. It seemed virtually unstoppable. Congresswoman Martha Griffiths was quoted, I believe, in 1970 as saying, the revolution is over and has been won. The rest is a mopping up operation. And in the 72 Congress, there were more women's rights bills passed, I believe, than in any other time. So, but nothing so symbolized the widespread support for the women's movement and the sense among politicians that the American public supported it as that overwhelming victory of the ERA in 1972 in Congress. There were very few people that voted against it. And afterwards, the states were scrambling to be the first to ratify. And, you know, it sailed through with many ratifications during the next year and then many more the next year. And by 1975, only four more were needed. Little did people realize that only one more victory would come. And that was Indiana in January of 77. So at the time of the Houston Conference, feminists were concerned. They were still hopeful, and there were fights going on in the 15 unratified states, as they were called. But people were worried, and Phyllis Schlafly and the ERA critics saw the IWI as just an effort to get it through. Schlafly loved alliteration, loves alliteration. She's very much part of the political scene today. She said that it was a federally funded festival for frustrated feminists.
She galvanizes this effort. It becomes very powerful. But she is able to become, through she and her supporters, become influential in some of the state conferences.
Yes.
And there's quite a bit of controversy and acrimony at these, leading up to the International Women's Year Conference in Houston.
Exactly. Those are where the real fight took place by Houston. The delegates had already been elected, and it was more like carrying out a course that everyone sort of knew was going to happen. But what had happened was that the International Women's Year Commission was first created back in 1974 by President Ford. It was supposed to coordinate U.S. participation in the UN-sponsored International Women's Year program and a major conference in Mexico City. So they did coordinate that, but they were also charged by Ford with coming up for recommendations for how to make this a more perfect union and a better society for women. And so they were engaged, they did produce a massive, well-researched report. But after that conference in Mexico City, Bella Abzug and a number of others said, we need a conference that's a grassroots conference that gives the women of the nation an opportunity to help write these themselves. And they really believed, again, as I said, that it would help to expand the movement. But by that time, Schlafly believed that they had largely stopped the ERA bandwagon. And so they were furious when the federal government, when Congress gives $5 million to have these conferences to gain women's advice, and also the president had appointed feminists to lead it. And then, of course, Jimmy Carter inherits this program, and he appoints Bella Abzug herself to lead it, and she's perceived as by Schlafly and others as an arch enemy and one of the most radical feminists. She wasn't, but she was perceived that way. And so they were very angry that these conferences were even being held. They believed that they were quite right that the anti-ERA people were shut out of the leadership positions of this, and a few tokens here and there on the state organizing groups. And so they regarded this as yet another example of federal government taking one side of a national debate.
And then when Houston happens, you have the conference that was expected. Phil Schlafly has her own conference, not across the street, but almost.
Yes. But they had those showdowns, as you mentioned, at the state meetings. But the conservatives were only able to elect about 20% of the delegates to Houston. They had hearings in Congress that Jesse Helms, a key ally of Schlafly, sponsored to complain about these conferences being rigged and conservative women being shut down. And they only gained total control of a few of them. But what they were still trying to do was to get it shut down, to stop the program before the Houston conference ever happened. But when by the end of the summer it was clear that it was going forth, and they knew that because of all the battles that summer at the state conference that the press would be there in huge numbers, they said, okay, we are going to take this opportunity to try to have our message shown. We can't do it through the Houston conference and our 20% delegates. So they started organizing a lot of their people who had shown up for the state conferences and more, come to Houston. We're going to have a massive pro-life, pro-family rally, and we are going to send a message to the nation that IWI conference does not speak for us.
It's pretty interesting because it seems for a couple of decades, every time Phil Schlafly kind of has a defeat, she gets stronger. She's a very good organizer.
She was a brilliant organizer. As I said earlier, I don't think that this could have been done without her. I don't think it would have been done without her. I think even the conservative men earlier in the decade thought she was on a wild goose chase. Of course, a lot of them tried then hard to help her succeed once it was happening. But I think what happened was that the new right strategists who were wanting to exploit social issues, nonetheless, they saw from her how you actually put together a movement of social conservatives. Because a lot of the people who were social conservatives were in groups that didn't get along with each other. You have Roman Catholics, you have Mormons, you have Southern Baptist and evangelical and fundamentalist churches that were not even very political. And she somehow managed to put together all of these into a smooth, united coalition against feminism and federally funded feminism. And they took note, and they saw that she could get that by working in opposition to feminism, embracing the title pro-family movement, that they could put together a very strong and politically powerful coalition. And I guess what I'm saying is she showed them the way to do that.
Is it fair to say that social conservative movements that are strong now owe a political debt to that period?
Yes, I think that they have their basis in that period. What's striking to me is that in the early 70s that the two parties were on the same side on large, and there were differences, but both Republicans and Democrats at the national level had feminists who were active and strong within their parties. Men even like Nixon felt obliged to cater to them. Ford, I believe, was more genuinely supportive, and his wife very supportive. But by 1980, what had happened was that this massive movement against the ERA during the IWI, which I think is a transformative event, turns into an enduring social movement that then, working together with the new right, who saw how they could work with Schlafly to gain more control within the Republican Party. And that what happened is that the two parties choose up sides, in other words, during the decade, with the Democrats continuing to support feminism, sometimes cautiously, and the Republican Party deciding that they are going to become the pro-family Party, that they dropped at the 1980 Republican National Convention. The party had been supporting the Equal Rights Amendment for 40 years, and they dropped it from their platform, and they also made it a strong pro-life platform. What I'm arguing in the book that I'm working on now is that these great debates over women's rights during the 70s, when women on both sides of the issue about what the federal government's policies ought to be took this very seriously. They were essentially looking at how should our society and our government change its policies to go along with the massive social and economic changes that had been taking place. So they knew that how the government responded was going to be important. Was the government going to try to reinforce the old ways and buttress them, or was it going to retrofit to fit the new conditions? And it was a very important debate. It was trivialized by the press as, you know, a catfight, which – and the feminists and the conservatives both hated that because they knew what they were talking about was really quite serious. And but as the personal becomes political and these issues that were very laden with religious and moral significance are pushed to the forefront of our political debate, the public and the politicians are finding this compromise much more difficult. And indeed, it becomes a dirty word. And compromise is less acceptable to either side because the issues are seen as moral issues. And so you add – so the country's being polarized like that. And then you add to that the fact that the two parties choose up sides. And so you end up in 1980 with a society that's not only highly polarized – but bitterly partisan. And a lot of the bitter partisanship comes because people feel like their people on the other side are morally suspect.
I think one of the fascinating things about being a historian is being able to peel back the layers, you know, with 40 years of hindsight, because certainly not many people in from 1975 to 1977 thought that no matter how loud this debate was and no matter how angry people were with each other, that it would have serious tentacles that would reach in well into now the 21st century.
Yes, I think you're right. I think that the 1980 election was a big shock to a lot of people who didn't think that was going to happen, and they did not see the major right turn coming to the extent that it came, or that it would endure as long as it has, and that the society would remain bitterly polarized as it remains to this day. So I think you're right. I think a lot of people were very surprised at the emergence of these developments.
Marjorie Sproul is a professor of history at the University of South Carolina. She was on the University of Arkansas campus this month to speak at a symposium sponsored by the Diane D. Blair Center of Southern Politics and the University of Arkansas Clinton School of Public Service. She spoke with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums during her visit to Northwest Arkansas.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs.
It's 12:08 in Little Rock from KAY. This is Stephen Stills, Crosby, Nash & Young. For Rick Morris in Sheraton, Iowa, this is Southern Man from the new Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young album, Southern Man.
The legendary North American AM radio station KAAY launched on September 3, 1962. Located in Little Rock and at 1090 on the AM radio dial, KAAY was heard in some 40 U.S. states, half of Canada into Alaska, Central and South America, and the Caribbean. KAAY was formed from KTHS AM out of Hot Springs. On the air since 1924, KTHS was one of the state's oldest radio stations and its first 50,000-watt AM station. KTHS, standing for Come to Hot Springs, broadcast from the Arlington Hotel downtown. The station Foundation also had the distinction of launching the duo Lum and Abner, who based their gentle country comedy out of a general store in Pine Ridge in Montgomery County and were real-life natives of Mena in Polk County. KTHS moved its operations to Little Rock in 1953, was acquired by the Lynn Broadcasting Corporation in 1962, and relaunched as KAAY AM 1090 that fall. Due to KAAY's 50,000-watt power and strategic location, the radio station worked with the U.S. government to broadcast American propaganda into Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis, just weeks after the station had went on the air in Little Rock with its new call letters. U.S. President John F. Kennedy later sent the station a letter of commendation. Listeners today might be surprised at the wide variety of music that can be heard on the mighty 1090. As one of the station's slogans went, "We play all kinds of music for all kinds of people," and literally millions tuned in to the friendly giant.
Music Radio with Steve Scott. It's 1:37. We'll be out here at Radio Shack on Rodney Parham across from Kmart till 3:30 this afternoon. I'll tell you what. Let's see. Next blue car that pulls in, I'll give you a copy of Eric Burton's Sun Secrets album. All right? Next blue car. Just come up here. Well, here we are right here. Well, all right. Let's try a red car now. Next red car that pulls in, you too will get a copy of Eric Burton's Sun Secrets. We're at Radio Shack, where you can find the best speakers. And I'm talking about Optimus and Nova. Now, these speakers are sold only by Radio Shack, and they're guaranteed, get this, forever. Like, they're guaranteed forever. That's all you can say about it. You need to stop out and check them out. Optimus and Nova. Ask Bob, Randy, Betty, or Joe behind the counter, and they'll tell you all about it. At Radio Shack on Rodney Parham, right across from Kmart.
Some see similarities between KAAY and the TV sitcom WKRP in Cincinnati, though Hugh Wilson, the show's creator, says he based it on his experiences working for a similar AM Top 40 station in Atlanta, KQXI. Little Rock native Frank Bonner starred as WKRP sales manager Herb Tarlick. KAAY was located at 1425 West 7th Street in a former doctor's office near the state capitol. But the radio station studio is just one of many of Little Rock's cultural landmarks displaced by construction of the I-630 Wilbur D. Mills Freeway right through the middle of the city. KAAY relocated north to 2400 Cottondale Lane near the Arkansas River in late 1976.
So the years spin by, and now the bar is 20.
During the day, state and national news reports, farm reports, and more were also a big part of KAAY programming. But it was the music of the mighty 1090 and its reach that made the radio station such an enduring international broadcasting legend. There was the eclectic Top 40 format, and at night, when the KAAY signal reached its peak strength, an early underground rock program called Beaker Street took over the air. Letters arrived in Little Rock bearing far-flung postmarks and exotic stamps requesting songs or posters or photographs or anything from bands like Frigid Pink, Savoy Brown, or Quicksilver Messenger Service, rock groups decidedly not topping the charts in America or any country for that matter. Dale Seidensorts, or Clyde Clifford, launched the Beaker Street program in 1966 from the KAAY transmitter site in Wrightsville in southern Pulaski County. And Beaker Street was the final program heard on the original KAAY 1090 AM on April 3rd, 1985. But while the KAAY call letters and frequency continued to live on with a religious-themed format, and Beaker Street was resuscitated twice for life at a couple of now-defunct Little Rock classic rock stations, there will never be another mighty 1090.
In the circle game.
And all good things must come to an end. For everyone who has been here at this station, to all of you who have shared our pleasures and our happinesses, thank you. From us, our best wishes, and goodbye. This is KAAY, Little Rock.
In its entirety is Brontosaurus by The Move, as heard on Clyde Clifford's Beaker Street on KAAY from June 28, 1970.
Tangle wrapper. She will let you stroke her head.
Brontosaurus by the move. Clyde Clifford, Beaker Street, and KAY, good morning.
Brontosaurus by the move, as heard on Clyde Clifford's Beaker Street on the legendary KAY Little Rock's 1090 on June 28, 1970. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer of Arkansongs is Keith Merks. For more information, visit arkansongs.org.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Who's Hungry in America and efforts to address their needs? Then more than a third of marriages in the U.S. are now between people of different faiths. Religious traditions and challenges for interfaith families, all coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
Listen tomorrow from 9 to 11 a.m. on KUAF 3.
And this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Farmington. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. One quick note, a memorial service for the late William Harrison will be held Sunday, December 15th at 4 p.m. at the Fayetteville Public Library. A reception will follow. Bill Harrison was a co-founder of the Creative Writing Department and the Masters in Fine Arts program at the University of Arkansas, as well as the published author of several novels, short stories, and screenplays. The community is invited to attend. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas. Antoinette Grajeda and Kyle Kellums will be back with you tomorrow for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Until then, thank you so much for listening and have a good Monday.
Oh, the benches were stained with tears and perspiration. The birdies were flying from tree to tree. There was little to say, there was no conversation. As I stepped to the stage to pick up my